of Acts, what do you see? You see Jews, especially up front in the first 12 chapters. You see Jews persecuting Jews. Yeah, and you see those Jews who are being persecuted, those Jews who are believers, who become Christians, who are being persecuted by their own people, are given protection and given providential care by God. And I believe that that is what this is referring to. The 1,260 days equals 42 months, equals 3.5 years, equals the Old Testament phrase, time, times, and half a time. It's all half of seven. And that means that there's an interruption or a corruption of what should be. In other words, it's not God interrupting or God corrupting. It's just saying that this isn't how it's going to all end. This is just a temporary situation. It's a finite period of time. To say 1,000 years is like an indefinite period of time. It's like a long time, okay? But to say 42 months is very specific. Remember what Jesus said to the church at Smyrna, you're going to have tribulation for 10 days. Well, it doesn't have to mean 10 literal days, but it means a very short period of time, especially compared to, 2,000 or 1,260 days. It's a much shorter period of time. It's all relative. 10 days, 1,260 days, 1,000 years, right? It's just all relative to each other. Wouldn't it be good if we studied numbers for a while, like numerology? And by the way, I just finished the handout for that. It's like 600 pages, it's not that long, but it feels like it. And there's just so much to say, and I did a lot of reading. I know more about numerology now than I ever have. And I will say, some of that is beneficial, and some of it is speculative, okay? So we will bring that out in our class. We'll talk about that because you can go and dabble in numbers and come up with all kinds of theories and plausible, speculations. But we want to stay on track here. And then there's war in heaven. Why is there war in heaven, do you suppose? Remember, we did talk about this a little bit, but for a refresher, why is there war in heaven? Who's in heaven now? Remember what, if I am correct, and Satan has made himself, not God making him, but Satan has made himself an enemy specifically of God's Son. And now where is God's Son? He's in heaven. And where is Satan? He's in the heavenly realm. Okay, when we say heaven, we simply mean the spiritual realm in this context. Okay? Somebody's got to go. Because God is not going to allow Satan to have free domain in the spiritual realm where God is when his Son is there on his throne. So not only has Jesus defeated Satan at the cross, but now he's basically evicting him from his favored position because, remember, he is an angel and he does have power. And there's a lot of questions you'll have about all this I cannot answer. I cannot answer them for myself any better than I can for you. But I'm just trying to say this as practically, staying with the text as practically as possible. There's war in heaven for a reason. That's because you can't have the victor and the conquered there together. The conquered needs to go. Kyle. Well, if we're going by the timeline we're given here, it would be after the cross, after Jesus ascends to the throne, okay, which is after the cross and after his ministry. So there is a sequence to all this here. We have the cross, we have his burial, we have his resurrection, we have his ascension to the throne, and then the war in heaven in which Satan is expelled. Not only Satan is expelled, but all these angels that rebelled against God with him, that sided with him, they also. That's the dragon and his angels. They're waging war. They're not strong enough, it says in verse 8. No longer is there a place found for them in heaven. Keep in mind, heaven doesn't mean the final resting place of God's people in this context. It simply really means the domain in which God lives would be heaven to us. Okay? And so the dragon is thrown down, and then here John does the aside. Remember I said that? He does a little aside every once in a while and gives you a literal rendition of what's happening. So it's a vision. So in the vision, the sign is of this great dragon, but he steps aside to tell you that this dragon is the devil and Satan. Satan with a capital S is appropriate, because now this devil has a name. This devil is a specific personage who deceives the whole world. And he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. In other words, their place of activity is going to be in the world of men, among human beings. That's where they're going to be active. And then that kind of pauses from that scene there, and John says, I heard a loud voice talking about the reign of Christ over God's kingdom. And then speaks about, in verse 10, the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down. Which is another reason why he's thrown down, is because he's been sitting there accusing God of having fellowship with people who are unworthy of that fellowship. But now that there is the blood of Christ to offer for atonement, now that Christ has died and the historical reality of his cross is there in God's view, that is a historical and biblical reality. Now the accusation is no longer valid. Yes, we are unworthy left to ourselves, but it's through Christ that we are made worthy. Through the blood of Christ, we are made worthy. And so that's what this is saying here. The accuser's been thrown down. There's no place for him anymore. There's no place for the accusations anymore. The accusations hold no validity. There's no credibility to the accusations. Ivan. Well, he is singular in himself, of course, but he does have a lot of, I can't even use the word minions anymore, because everyone's going to think the little yellow characters from Pixar. But that's what they are. They're minions. That's what a minion is. They're demons. They're devils. Okay, they're not the devil, but they are devils by definition. And so, he does have a lot of help with that. He does have a kingdom. Jesus refers to that. That he does have a kingdom. It's a kingdom that's doomed to fail, but it's a kingdom nonetheless. There's been lots of kingdoms in history, human kingdoms that fail and failed, but they were kingdoms nonetheless, right? So just because he's a failure and just because he's Satan doesn't mean he can't have a kingdom. He does have a kingdom, which implies organization and probably hierarchy and some kind of scheme, as Paul says. We're aware of Satan and his schemes. There's some kind of planning or plotting. There's an attack going on there. And there's also an enemy that kingdom is going to resist or try to conquer. Okay, Will? To the identifiable Satan, the Satan. Correct. Not just a Satan. Okay? By the way, in the Old Testament, even God himself is referred to as a Satan. Did you know that? I don't have the verse in front of me. It is in Chronicles when God was resisting David, when David was taking a census of the people to find out how big his army was. It says that God was an adversary to him. Literally, that says God was a Satan, using the word in its descriptive sense, not in its noun or personification sense there, okay? Not referring to Satan the personage, but rather referring to what Satan is. You can be a Satan to someone. I can be a Satan to you, right? I mean, if I'm an adversary to you, then technically that's what I'm doing. And I believe that's what Peter was referred to as when Jesus spoke to him in Matthew 16 that Lori brought up earlier. You're acting like a Satan to me. You're an adversary to me. Now, that sounds weird to say that, you know, that God himself could be a Satan, but it underscores the point I was making earlier, is that our concept of Satan in the Old Testament is probably in need of review. It probably needs to, we need to go back there if we take the time to do so, and I do that in my book once again, to go back and re-examine, re-look at all these things that are said about Satan. And quite frankly, there's very little said about Satan in the Old Testament. There's very little said about the Satan in the Old Testament, but there's a lot said about him in the New Testament. He becomes a personage, an enemy, once again, okay? And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even when faced with death. Who's this speaking about but those who believe in the victor, Christ himself? Christ is victorious. Those who believe in him are also victorious through him, not on their own, not on their own standing or on their own merit, but certainly through the power of Christ himself. They are victorious, which means we are victorious, which really means we are not going to be victorious, but that we are victorious right now as long as we remain faithful to who Jesus is and what we've promised him. And so now there's a warning here. For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath. He is very angry. He's angry at being beaten. He's angry at being overtaken at the cross when he thought he had a victory there. He only has a short time. What is that referring to, the short time? What's going to happen to Satan later on in Revelation? He's going away. He's going to be bound, right, for 1,000 years. Again, it doesn't mean a literal 1,000 years, but it means a long time. And that's coming up. We see that in chapter 20, start verse 1 and 2, that Satan's going to be bound. So between here and that time, whenever that time is, historically, it doesn't matter to us right now, except to say that it's a short time, relatively speaking. Make sense? So Satan needs to act, and he needs to do something now in this context so that he can inflict as much damage and, if possible, in his mind, defeat the church. And in defeating the church, that will be a defeat to Christ and a defeat to God the Father. And Satan will somehow derive some kind of pleasure or satisfaction or, you know, whatever it is that he's looking for. In my opinion, Satan really doesn't have a shred of hope for any of this to happen or for any of this to be successful. But he presses forth anyway, right? Just like people do when they don't have a shred of hope. And I'm speaking about people who choose to be unbelievers and put their belief instead in the earth or in evolution or, you know, in paganism or in all kinds of other useless things, useless beliefs, useless philosophies. They don't offer a shred of hope for the life to come, but they're going to believe in it anyway. Because that's what people do, right? Because they're proud and they're arrogant and they're not willing to let go of their beliefs and recognize and surrender to the authority and the victory of Christ. For what it's worth. Verse 13, the dragon saw he was thrown down. He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. Again, who is this? The faithful remnant, right? The faithful remnant of Israel. And I believe, this is me speaking, you don't have to agree with this, but the context does indicate that this woman it begins as the faithful remnant of Israel, and it simply metamorphs into the faithful remnant, God's people, wherever they are, whoever they are, but God's people, Christians. Two wings of the great eagle were given to this woman so she could fly into the wilderness. Now, is this literally happening to the church? No. This isn't, it's not like the church took up and took flight into the wilderness. Obviously, this is all visionary, but it does talk about that, there is a provision made for the church. The church is not left to itself. It's not left on its own. It hasn't been abandoned by God. God isn't up in heaven saying, y'all fight the good fight of faith and hopefully I'll see you up in heaven, right? And offers no help or encouragement or even providential help, miraculous help even at that time for his church. He is right there with them, helping them and guiding them and supporting them. Yeah. Well, change is a good word. Transition might be a good word. Probation might be a good word. Okay, a time of testing, there is going to be trials. I mean, look at every time someone goes in the wilderness, they're being tested. Whether it was, like you said, Israel or Elijah or, Jesus himself, there's a test out there in the wilderness. And you're right, coming out of that test, they're strengthened, they're renewed, they're re-energized, rejuvenated, etc. His wilderness was the water, but...
before it was building the ark out in the middle of...
Right. Okay, so yeah, the wilderness does stand for something, but in my understanding, the wilderness is purposely indistinct. It's not meant to be a certain city. It's not meant to be a certain place. It's just a location, a generic, empty, unnamed, obscure location. And it's meant to be that way, okay? Because... we go out there in that wilderness to be tested. We don't go into a city where there's other people and other amenities and conveniences. We go into the difficulty, into the place where there is not so much there to support us except for God himself. Okay? So a lot of good things can come out of this discussion. The more you dig here, by the way, the deeper you go. And I'm not saying that deeper you go means that we're now being more and more speculative. Actually, there's just more and more going on that we just didn't see at first glance. Okay? It's like an onion, right? Anyone watch Shrek? It's like an onion. So, and there she was nourished times and half a time. There's that 1,260-day period, 42 months, 3.5 years. It all means the same thing. It is a limited time of probation, a limited time of trial. It is not the final plan. It's not meant to be the final plan. It is just a time of difficulty that they have to get through. And that's what the church is going through. What's the serpent's response to this? Pours water like a river out of his mouth after the woman in order to sweep her away with a flood. Someone says, well, what is this water? Well, in this case, water is being used destructively. Water can, of course, be very positive. We need water to survive. We need water for our plants. You know, every living thing, so far as I know, in some way or another, needs water in order for life to be. But this water here is destructive. It's kind of we'll see this in Revelation 13. Especially that there's all kinds of imitations that Satan does. He imitates what God does, but he tweaks it. He perverts it. And I'll get into more detail as we get into 13. But here we have a perversion. You know, God is flooded the world to get rid of sin, to get rid of sinful people. What is Satan doing? He's flooding the world to get rid of what? God's people. It's just the opposite. Using the same mechanism, so to speak, using the same agent, water, using the same idea, but going after the entirely different people, the wrong people, because that's what Satan does. He does everything wrong, and that's why he always fails. And so we're seeing that there is this imitation, this flood that comes into the world, but it isn't a flood of literal water because this is a vision, but it is a flood of something. What is it a flood of? Lies be a good answer, and probably an all-encompassing answer. Okay, remember, Satan is the father of lies. Jesus said that himself of Satan in John 8:44, and he wasn't just talking about a Satan, you know, like an adversary. He was talking about the Satan. Satan, the devil, is the father of lies. So he's very specific about who he's talking about, and he's very descriptive about who he's talking about as well. So we could say, in a most general sense, that these are lies. What kind of lies do you suppose? Lies about what? Or lies to what end? In other words, lying about what for what purpose? What was that? Phil?
Lies about everything that God wants to do, and Eve is a very good example in the Old Testament of what he did with Eve.
Okay.
He turned everything that God said and made it different than what God really said.
Oops, that's not what I want. Yeah, Paul actually does say something about that here in 2 Corinthians 11. You know, he talks about the serpent. We always think Satan is the serpent. The serpent is Satan. I'm not convinced of that. You can be if you want to. I have a different opinion about that, but I don't want to pursue that. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the serpent is certainly acting as a Satan. There's no question in my mind of that. He is acting as a Satan, and he deceived Eve by his craftiness. And then Paul says, your minds, I'm afraid, will be led astray from the simplicity and purity of devotion to Christ. Then he goes on and talks about, basically, false teachers. What are false teachers peddling? Lies. Lies about God. Lies about Christ. Lies about the resurrection. Right? Lies about doctrine. Lies about Paul, lies about the apostles, lies about authority. There are all kinds of lies here. Where all these come from? Why are these so prevalent all of a sudden in the new church? Well, if you go to Revelation and you see that for what it is, you understand that Satan has unleashed a flood. And that flood is targeting the church. But the church, and I'm speaking now of the faithful remnant of the church, is smart enough to recognize a lie for what it is and doesn't buy into all that. Some will. The weaker elements and so on will. And I say that because Paul says that, or really Peter says that about Paul. For 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter says here, he talks about Paul and the wisdom given to him. Wrote to some things to you in his letters, and which are hard to understand, he says in verse 16, which the untaught and unstable distort as they do the rest of the scriptures. So there are people in the church that are weak and untaught and ungrounded and really are novices, but think that they're smart because you get a little bit of knowledge, and that's a dangerous thing, right? So that's still happening today, by the way, but the idea here is that Satan has flooded the church with all of this antagonism, all of this deceit and deception, all of these lies, this false doctrine, and particularly false teachers, which would be another good answer to the flood. It's false teachers and false teaching in general. And there was a lot of that going on. The apostles, in teaching the gospel, did not teach in a vacuum of people open-minded, ready to receive the gospel without any other ideas or philosophies or anything else. They're just sitting there waiting, you know, they're vacant-minded, and then the gospel comes along and fills their mind, and suddenly they believe in the truth. That is not how that happened, any more than it happens that way today. So we have to understand that, what Satan is doing and the effect that it is having on the church, I didn't want 13, I want 12, we're still in 12. And so this is what is going on, and it says here that the earth, and they, by the earth it means those who are not the woman, really, okay? Those who are not of the faithful remnant, those who are not even of Christ, helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river. So what do people generally do? They listen to these lies. They listen to this false teaching put out by the false teachers. They listen to these deceptions and they swallow it up as though it were the truth. Is that still happening today? Of course it is. But it was happening in particular back at this time because Satan is trying to undermine the church, undermine its power, undermine its success, undermine its teaching, and so on. So the dragon, in response to that, was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children. Who are the rest of her children? And this is where I would say that would be the believers of all kinds. Okay, those who came, or let me say it this way, those who also believed in the promises that the woman had kept alive for so long. They believed that Jesus is the Messiah, he is the Savior of the world, he is the Redeemer of sinful men, and they believe in that testimony, they believe in that gospel, and by believing, they become his followers. These are his children, really the woman's children. Right? Any questions or rebuttals? Anyone got any good stories to tell? Anything? Here, Jim.
I'm just thinking about, you know, that thing you were saying about Satan is losing. He loses the battle. But there's still some misery involved in that. And, you know, that's, I don't know, that I can't dismiss it.
You think what?
I can't dismiss that misery.
Oh, yeah. 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 There's a lot about this whole thing that's troubling, you know, about what Satan does and who he is and how we deal with him. Remember what we talked about in our prayer class? Because coincidentally, or not, you know, we're talking about Satan in this class and we're also talking about him on Sunday morning. Remember what we said about Satan is that he wants you to focus on fighting rather than fighting against him. Our fight is against Satan and all that he stands for. And sometimes we transfer that fight to people that we care about or to the church or to the issues or to, you know, this doctrine or that doctrine. And we sit there and waste a lot of time and energy. Anyone that was in the church throughout the 60s, the 70s, knows that there was a lot of time consumed and a lot of energy devoted to dealing with things that in the end could have been settled much easier and in the process took our attention away from what we should have been doing, and that was evangelism. And then the 80s, we all got soft, and the 90s as well, we all got soft and lazy, and we stopped fighting because we were so overwhelmed with all the fighting that had gone on the last two decades that we stopped fighting for anything. We just were in survival mode. And now we're looking at churches dwindling, and we're looking at attendances dwindling, and we're seeing a lack of drive and enthusiasm, and that's Satan at work. That is Satan forcing us to focus on fighting rather than fighting Satan. And so he's very effective still. I mean, what he has put into place there is still very effective, unfortunately. I don't want to give Satan any credit, but I have to recognize that he is still very much, you know, active and effective in his own way. He's going to fail. All of that's going to fail in the big picture scheme of things. But doesn't mean that he's not going to have a lot of casualties to take down with him in the process. Okay? Anyone else? Will?
Yeah, I'm noticing a pattern. Satan at first he was aiming high, wanted to be God himself, and went for the Son of God. Couldn't do that.
Keeps going lower and lower, doesn't he? Whatever he can. Yeah. No, it's good that you notice that, because that's exactly what happens there. We're seeing him trying to go after God and then go after, you know, keeps getting lower and lower in the strata there. And he's as low as he can get. And pretty soon he's not even going to have the church, and he's going to have the world, but what will he have? I mean, in the end, what will he have won? Remember what Jesus says, if you gain the whole world but lose your soul, what have you got? Nothing. By the way, I was going to do a lesson on the one number that we're not going to cover in our numerology, and that would be zero. Because the Bible doesn't really have anything to say about zero specifically. But it has a lot to say about no one and nothing. And there's a lot to say on that. So when Jesus talks about nothing, a man will have nothing. If he loses his soul, he'll have nothing. He's really talking about he'll have zero. But he doesn't use the word or the idea of zero or the numerical value or the emptiness of the value of zero. He just says nothing. Right? So, interesting. Very fascinating to me. But and in fact, you might say even that the whole world started out of nothing. In fact, the Greek phrase for that, how God created everything, was ex nihilo, out of nothing, out of zero. God brought numbers, so to speak. That's amazing, because if you multiply anything times zero, what do you get? Zero. So you can multiply all you want to zero, but if you don't have the power to overcome that zero, you have nothing. So there is something to all that, and I don't want to pursue that here, and I might say something more about that in our numerology class, but it is a fascinating idea to see that. Okay. Anyone else before I move on here? Nita.
I feel sometimes that we're like the prophet in the cave saying there's no one left that's faithful, and God reprimands him and tells him that he does have faithfulness.
Right.
When you look and you're able to see it on the news so much, but the Super Bowl, both quarterbacks, what did they do before the game?
I have no idea. Oh, I didn't catch the beginning of the game, so. Well, that's impressive.
The college that just had another murder, or people murdered. The radio this morning was talking about the fact that they have been worshiping 24 hours a day for the last several days. People coming and going, singing praises to God, praying. So, the world may be an evil place that we see all the wickedness in.
Right.
But God is still at work. And Christians are still trying to make a difference.
Right. And to add to your point, we are not alone in saving the world. I know sometimes we think we are. Like the salvation of the world is all up to us. It's all weighing on our shoulders. God is not so foolish as to put the salvation of so many people on our weak and feeble shoulders. Okay. Now, we have a part in all of this. We do. We have a part in proclaiming the word and supporting the truth and protecting the truth amongst ourselves. But as far as the salvation of the world is concerned, that's really God's business. We're just workers in the field. But it's God's business. Okay? So that is a good point to make there. All right, anyone else? Okay, we're going to cover chapter 13 in 2 minutes. Okay. No, we're not. Chapter 13 is probably one of the more pivotal chapters, the most sought after, the most read, the most opinionated over, the most misunderstood, I think, chapters in the book of Revelation. If there's going to be a chapter that everyone goes to, it's the chapter with the beast in it, and then the mark of the beast, right? And that's where we are, is in this chapter. Let's at least introduce it before we depart here tonight. It says, the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. What is the sea? The sea is not the ocean. The sea is humankind. That is how it's portrayed. Later on in chapter 17, John will tell you that it is the multitude of the people. It is the peoples. So when he says that the dragon, remember that's Satan, standing on the sand of the seashore, Satan is bringing out of the people an enemy of his own creation. Think about this. What did God do when he created Adam? He brought Adam out of the dust and breathed life into him. And now Satan is bringing his own Adam, so to speak, out of the sea and giving life to him. Except it's a perversion of all that God had done, and it's doomed to fail. It doesn't have the strength, the caliber, the character, ability that God has through creating Adam and the human race. It's a failure to start with. But this is what he's doing. It's a giant mockery. And this beast comes out of the sea, 10 horns, 7 heads, and then 10 diadems or crowns on his heads. And then on the heads were blasphemous names. Blasphemy is profaning that which is sacred. Blasphemy is against God. So what is this? Well, whatever it is meant to be an opponent that goes against God's people, a very foreboding adversary. It's not Satan himself duplicated, but it is a puppet of Satan, and it derives its power from Satan, who derives his power from the people. And that's all the time we have for that. So just leave you in wonder and mystery, shrouded in mystery, until we can return here next week. All right. Thank you so much for being here tonight. We'll transition and then have a couple words and a song here in a minute.